Well, good morning. My name is Per Fogring. In this segment of the Radio Zine, we're going to be talking some heavy-duty philosophy. Guest is Philip Comella, who's a radio show host and the author of a book, The Collapse of Materialism. So, Philip Comella, welcome to KABU.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me. It's great being here. Appreciate
yeah,
it.
Well, why don't we jump right into it? What is materialism? You know, we have our kind of daily version, but that's different from the philosophical version.
Yeah, well, materialism really is the undergirder to the way we look at the world, and it really is like the base lens. Specifically, what it means is that ultimate reality is a thing or a particle, example being the God particle, which the folks are looking for in the Large Hadron Collider in Europe. It says that there is no purpose or direction to the world because things don't have any meaning. It says that there is no connection between consciousness and the mind or the physical world. An example would be genes. We think that we are just mechanical bits of pieces. We call these things genes, and that these genes operate outside the control of the mind. This is really the governing principle to modern science. Most modern science, if not all of them, are materialists. And so that's sort of the baseline that we need to understand to then go to the next step, which is what's wrong with materialism and why is it no longer accounting for the full range of what we know as human experience.
Well, we might ask, this leads us, you know, what exactly is physical matter? I mean, you know, I'm sitting here in a radio studio and a solid table here and a creaky old microphone and things. So that, you know, on one level, that is the physical world, but we're going deeper than that. So what is matter?
Well, I think that this is where things get interesting, because you sort of reach the same conclusion from approaching things from different directions. We know, for example, that through something known as quantum theory, that what we call matter is really not matter. We assume that this matter is made of little ball bearings, little stuff, little things, that when you break them down, you find smaller things. Well, quantum theory, which is the governing scientific principle of physical reality, says that that's wrong. Werner Heisenberg, the famous German physicist who was one of the founders of quantum theory, said famously that atoms are not things. If you read any book on quantum theory right now, or any paper for that matter, you will see that everyone is saying that what we think are things is really not stuff. They're really energy packets. They're waves of nothing. Some folks go as far as to say that it's dream stuff. The world is all mental. So science has not caught up to quantum theory, or our understanding of what matter is has not incorporated quantum theory into our thinking. Okay, so the first answer is what we view as hard stuff is really not hard stuff. It really is an illusion, and we are part of the illusion. And that's something that we are gradually, in my opinion, come to grips with, because when you pound that table in front of you saying, well, that's really a hard table, that's matter, you're pounding it with something that exists on the same level. So we are spiritual beings, in my opinion, spiritual beings in a spiritual world, which is why the world seems so real to us.
Well, you know, what really boggles my mind is, you know, you read about the Big Bang theory, and according to that, at one time, well, at the very, very beginning of time, the entire universe, now we're talking about, you know, 200 billion galaxies and all that, the entire universe would fit into this room right here.
Right.
Well, what does that say about, you know, the density of matter? This stuff is packed so tightly, it just, well, like I said, it boggles the mind.
Right, right. And I think that I said it earlier that there's a couple of ways to reach the same conclusion, but what you just pointed out is very real and important, because scientists, you have to understand this, for scientists, they have to assume that this matter that formed the entire universe, that was present at the Big Bang, that it came from nothing, okay? Mm-hmm. And which to me is really hard to believe, how an entire universe of matter is going to come from nothing. And then at the beginning of time, according to the Big Bang, as you say, it was condensed into a pinpoint.
Well, do they
and
really
then it exploded?
Do they really? Go ahead.
But, no, I was just going to say, to me, there's a lot of, you know, when you compare what the Big Bang is to another theory, which is the mind first theory, this different perspective that I'm advocating does stop sounding so strange, because the Big Bang theory to me is the more radical theory.
Well, somewhere reading about the Big Bang theory, I read that they're not saying anything about what came before. They say something more like, you don't know because the Big Bang destroyed all the evidence.
Right.
So you have
if
there was a world before that, then we have no way of knowing what it was like.
Right. Stephen Hawking, I think in his book, A Brief History of Time, says it like this. I think he says that, you know, the equations break down at the Big Bang, mm-hmm. and which I think is another way of avoiding the question. They're avoiding the major question, which is that how can this miracle that something came from nothing possibly occur? And what's interesting about it, among other things, is that when we're young, I think a lot of us go through this stage, like, which is, you know, well, how did something come from nothing? And we just sort of put it off to the side and carry on with our lives. The reason why this is so important, it's not just an academic question, is that it tells us how to control the world and how to make a better world. Because if the world is created from the inside out, in other words, if it's consciousness first, then we know that to improve the world, we have to prove the state of the human spirit, which is another way of saying we need to be kinder, gentler, and more compassionate towards people, feed the hungry, shelter the homeless, educate the masses, instead of treating us all like a bunch of robots, where the object is to take drugs, surgically operate on the body, and treat each other as separate entities. And so the reason why this is important is because it tells us where the control mechanism is. And to me, it's inside of us. It's not outside of us. And so that's where things ultimately go for me.
Well, how's this for a theory, that before the Big Bang, there was a universe kind of like the one we have now that was actually imploding, and so there was a big crunch, and then the big crunch kind of led to a big bang. So then you'd have, I suppose, an infinite series of crunches and bangs, this eternally oscillating universe. Does that make any more sense?
Yeah, that is actually a theory. I don't know if you thought of that yourself, but that is actually a pretty popular theory. It's called the eternal return. I think that Paul Steinhardt from Princeton University is an advocate of that theory, where there's sort of it goes in and out, you know, oscillating. But, you know, to me, ultimately, the question is, what proof do we have of all that?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what evidence do we have? And I think the answer is we don't have any evidence.
Okay, well, let's give out the phone numbers for anybody who wants to call in and ask questions or comment. The number is 503-231-8187. So, well, what is the evidence for the Big Bang? I thought it was sort
well,
of. I thought it explained a lot of things that they couldn't explain any other way. But
well, first of all, the Big Bang is a theory. It is to me a materialistic metaphor for creation. The best evidence for the Big Bang is that there is this cosmic background radiation, which scientists have detected at the far reaches of the cosmos, and they have interpreted this background radiation as being sort of a cosmic fossil, sort of the afterglow from this primordial explosion. okay? But there is a big problem with the background radiation that gets swept under the rug, which is that the background radiation is homogeneous. It's even to about 1 in 100,000 parts per million, which means that it is much too smooth, much too even to have arisen from a chaotic explosion, okay? And so the problem then becomes, well, how do you explain a big bang, this cataclysmic explosion, this random event? How can you have a cataclysmic event like this where it leads to such mathematically ordered background radiation, okay?
Mm-hmm.
To me, and this is called a fine-tuning problem. How did it come to pass that the Big Bang was so finely tuned?
Do they have any explanation?
This, of course, leads... Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
So I was just going to ask, do they have any explanation for that?
Well, this is where the Big Bang gets more complicated, mm-hmm. which is that there's something called the inflationary Big Bang, which scientists say, and this is really the leading model, scientists say that in order to account for the background radiation, we have to assume that the universe inflated about 10 to the 40th power in 10 to the minus 35th second. So, and I'm not making this up.
Mm-hmm.
They have to say that there was this incredible inflation that inflated the universe so fast that the universe wound up being smooth across the horizon. And this is something, to me, what this means is that a finely tuned universe is really what we have. And the inflationary theory is really just a way to camouflage the fact that we are in a finely tuned universe. And by the way, finely tuned means an intelligence behind the scenes. So I think that what's going on in our scientific community right now is that there is evidence that there is an intelligence behind the scenes, but they aren't quite ready to deal with that because they don't want to bring a god or a spirit into their scientific model. So they're coming up with more complicated theories, like the inflationary Big Bang, to sort of cover up evidence of design.
Well, they wouldn't say that it just kind of evolved into that, that if it wasn't finely tuned, it wouldn't exist at all. It would have, I don't know, destroyed itself. So,
right.
The fact that it is finely tuned, to me, is just another way of saying that it exists.
Right. That leads to what is known as the anthropic principle, which is basically we know we live in a universe that's finely tuned for us,
mm-hmm.
and therefore there must be at least one universe that is finely tuned so we could live here, and that sort of leads to the into the multiverse, this
mm-hmm.
principle or this theory that there's actually an infinity of other universes that aren't so finely tuned, and we just happen to live in the finely tuned one.
Okay, we have Mark on the line. Mark, you're on the air.
All right, it's a relief, Mark, to hear. It's a relief to hear somebody speak about other theories besides the Big Bang theory. Because I know there are a few others out there. Could you maybe mention some of those other theories that disagree with the Big Bang?
Right. Okay. Well, there's really, I would say there's three general models. There's the Big Bang. Then there is the biblical creation, mm-hmm. which is founded in the book of Genesis, where the hand of God or through a miracle, an all-powerful being created the universe.
Right. Okay? It's not even less feasible than the first theory. What's the third one?
Right. And then what I'm advocating, and I'm not the only one, but I'm advocating it in my book, The Collapse of Materialism, is that we are actually living in a dream of God. That the world that we exist in is a projection of the mind. And that is why it seems real to us, and that is how something can come from nothing.
I like that.
See? So that is what I'm advocating, and even though it may sound incredibly radical when you compare it to the Big Bang, in my opinion, the Big Bang is more radical because it requires more assumptions. You have to find a way not only for something to come from nothing in the Big Bang, but you have to find a way for this exploding debris to assemble itself to the limits of mathematical order, including human life. And I have a hard time believing that. So those are the three. You know, there's the steady state model, which you've probably heard about, where matter is being constantly created. That was sort of debunked a couple years ago when the background radiation came up. But in my opinion, the world as a dream of God makes a lot more sense because it explains everything as opposed to only half of the world. Yeah.
Well, one question I have is, say you have this theory of this expanding universe, what does it expand into? How can you visualize nothingness? Space, because space is a thing, but what does this universe expand into according to the Big Bang theory?
Well, if you read the authors or the inventors of the Big Bang, they will say that at the Big Bang, space also was created, that matter and energy are expanding with space, like an expanding balloon, okay? Mm-hmm. And you got to understand that this is a model. It's a model. And the models that we build, that we let science build, are supposed to reflect reality. What we're trying to do in science is to find a model that will explain more and presumably everything. We might call that the theory of everything. And my premise is that the model of materialism is collapsing because it's failing to explain the full range of human experience.
Okay, we have another caller on the line. Dusty, you're on the air.
Hi. So I have a pet theory about the Big Bang, mm-hmm. and it's sort of physics-based, and it's sort of my answer to how it might have occurred or what might be sort of fueling it, per se. And that's sort of about black holes, mm-hmm. in that black holes are, you know, these singular sort of like... you know, they're essentially these vacuums in the middle of most galaxies, and their gravity is so dense that, you know, physics kind of break down in them. And in fact, time breaks down and mm-hmm. sort of goes backwards inside it, mm-hmm. I've heard. And so my theory is that all of the matter that exists out there in the sprawling, expanding universe eventually finds its way into one black hole or another. And then all of that matter, all of that substance is pulled backwards to the same point. And that collision is what the Big Bang was. And I was wondering what you thought of that theory.
Well, first of all, let me say that I think it's important to be open-minded and to be self-critical. I think yeah. on too many occasions we take what people, and specifically the scientists, and we could say the same thing about some religions, we take it at face value, we don't question it. So I think it's very healthy to use your own mind and to come up with your own ideas. I think that's what this is all about. My problem with the Big Bang, among other things, and I would have the same question with the black hole theory, is where is the guiding principle? Where is the organizing force that's going to get the matter to assemble itself into organized structures? Remember, the second law of thermodynamics says that things move towards a state of disorder. Okay? And so how can you get an explosion to move to a state of mathematical order? See, this I think is a critical issue right here, and that is really coming to the forefront because the world does seem so beautifully organized. So that's really a fundamental problem I have with a matter-first creation.
Okay, we have another caller on the line.
Yeah, hello?
Hello there. You're on
the
air.
Hello there. Yeah, listen, I only been listening to for a short time, but thank you for the program.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm just an ordinary, everyday person living in public housing, and when I think of things like the black hole and that, and it's I can't help it. It scares me. But anyway, what I wanted to say was I'm concerned about things like ending wars in this country, and I just wonder if any of your the thinking and the work on this program has, I guess it doesn't have a connection with ending wars in the world, and also I just wonder if the International Space Station comes into your thinking and work. But anyway, I appreciate the program, even though I don't understand all these things.
Okay, well, let's try and let's ask. Okay, what does your theory say about you know, ending war and things like that? Is there a connection, or is it sort of totally different?
No, that's a great question, and it is all about ending war. It's all about peace. What I'm saying is that we are united at the core of our beings. We really are one family. Carl Jung, the psychologist, called it the collective unconsciousness. And the notion that there's one divine mind permeates the entire field of spirituality and underlines most of the world's religions, the notion that there's one mind. I think that the goal of our world is to unite in physical form that which is united at the core of being, which is a fancy way of saying that the goal is peace. Morality is the rule of the universe. I think what we need in our world, to be really idealistic about this, we need something we can agree upon, something that is more important, that is deeper than the petty differences between us.
And she also asked about, does the space station have any impact on this at all?
I think what the space station does is it explores the miracle of our world. Okay? That's what it's saying. I would say the same thing about probing the depths of the oceans or the forests, the skies. I think the space station is exploring the miracle of our universe. What I would part company with is that I don't think we're going to find the secret to the universe out among the stars. I think we're going to find the secret of the universe inside of ourselves.
I see.
So okay. I go with the Eastern thinkers on that point.
Okay, we have another caller on the line. Hi, you're on the air. Somebody else on the another caller?
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
I was interested to hear you talk more specifically about consciousness. And, the whole idea you're talking about God, I think that might be kind of a red flag for some people. I wonder how you talk about in terms of, like, the historic sort of difference between, like, immanence versus transcendence. And then there's the whole idea that, you know, David Bohm talks about, like, the implicate order, and also talk about the idea of, like, synchronicity, how that relates mind and matter.
Those are all good points. And let me be clear. I think from a scientific standpoint, it is good not to burden an explanation with jargon so that people think that I'm somehow backdooring a religion into this. I think it's more healthy to describe things as neutrally as possible, such as the inner and the outer. I think the inner is really our inner consciousness, our emotions, and our thoughts. I do think that there is one mind at the base of reality. Okay? I think that scientists like David Bohm, they were giving a picture of the same thing. I think throughout time, spiritualists, philosophers, and scientists are describing the same thing in different words. Your point about synchronicity, I think, is great. I just did a blog yesterday on my website on synchronicity. because synchronicity, as you know, is really, to me, showing that there is a theme behind the story. You know, there's something strange going on where coincidences happen as if there's an author to the story of life. And to me, that shows a connection not only between us and the world, but it shows that somehow our events, our lives are interconnected in a complicated, mysterious way, but they're still connected. Okay?
But you keep saying that there's something behind. There's an intelligent. Why can't it just be implicit within?
I agree. You're right. I agree with you. It's not. We are the intelligence. Let me be very specific. There is no. I think the human mind is part of the one mind. You know. Remember, Hinduism says that Atman, the one self, is part of Brahman. Brahman is God. Okay, so I think Hinduism is correct. We are all part of the collective unconsciousness. It is inside of us. We are the intelligence, but it's our combined mind. It's our combined unconscious mind that I think is at the root of reality. Okay, and I'm not the only one who's ever said this. This is really the foundation of Eastern philosophy and the Western idealists.
Well,
how's
this for theory? That at the beginning of time, it was this giant consciousness that exploded, and that we are all tiny, tiny fragments of this consciousness, and we are trying to coalesce.
That's very close to what I'm saying. The only difference would be that I think it was an explosion of creativity, and it came from the inside out. Not from the outside in. You see, we will, in my opinion, I mean, we will never, this is what's so cool, I think. We could, I think, come to the conclusion in a couple centuries, perhaps, maybe decades, whoever knows, that indeed consciousness is at the root of reality. That all these guys like Deepak Chopra and Greg Braden and Amit Goswami, all these guys are right, okay? Consciousness is at the root of reality. But we will never know, in my opinion, how dreams are possible, how this world can be created. So I think that is the source of the religious sentiment. But what you just said, Tara, is very close to what I'm saying. Consciousness was the explosion. It was an explosion of creativity. We are children of God trying to find our way home, trying to coalesce, as you say, trying to make peace and unite the world. It's a far-flung, optimistic, idealistic vision, but that's what it is.
Well,
it's also known as... Go ahead.
Oh, you go ahead.
I was just going to say, it could also be called heaven on earth.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically what this leads to. This, to me, is what Jesus Christ and the other messengers of God, whatever we're going to call them, this is what they were talking about. This is the heaven on earth, where we find that we are at the source of the controls, and we unite in physical form that which is united at the core of reality. Just imagine this. Imagine that we accepted the principle that we are united with the same power that we believe in the law of gravity. Just imagine what kind of world we could make. And that's, I think, where we need to go. We need to absorb that truth into our work, into our lives, into our culture. Then we end war. Then we start having a better place to live. Incredibly optimistic, incredibly idealistic, but as they say, shoot high, aim high, dream big, and that's what I'm trying to do.
Well, I would say when it comes to ending war, try anything that works for you. But let me say to our audience, this is KBOO's Radio Zine, and we're talking with Philip Comella about his book, The Collapse of Materialism. And if you want to call in with a comment or a question, the number is 503-231-8187. We got Jimmy on the line. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning, good morning. I just want to make a singular comment that I think that this type of conversation that we're having here today is exactly what we need to be doing. It's not necessarily about finding answers and words to describe those answers, but just this notion that you guys are tossing around of considering this stuff, avoiding a particular dogma in regard to trying to describe what we're experiencing together, and the notion of you know, the fact that we are all connected in this type of thing. So kudos to you for doing that. Keep up the conversation. Keep this going. KBOO's not known for necessarily being a very spiritual radio station, but it's like we're having gospel hour here today. So thank you very much. I'm sure a lot of people are being energized by that. So I'm going to get off the phone now and just want to say thanks.
Thank you.
I should break out into a version of the old time religion, you know.
With
25 verses to it.
this is the update. This is the updated gospel hour, though.
I think we got another caller on the line. Hi,
interesting, and I think that it's quite exciting that you're bringing this to, especially to KBOO, for the reasons that you were just saying. And I have a question to pose for you. It all sounds fine. As a person who's been off and on a practicing Zen Buddhist for a good number of years, I'm not unfamiliar with what you're talking about. Here's the question, though. Right now, people are convinced of a completely other set, another paradigm, another way of looking at everything. And in that, there are many, many people, and now especially it's known to us, including the entire planet, suffering greatly because of this. We, if we choose to go with what you're saying, does it imply to you that we sit around and wait in a very positive way, of course, for this change to come about miraculously in the hearts of people who are persuaded that materialism, and I mean that in all aspects of the word, the material paradigm is the reality, and therefore do not want to let go of the power which they currently hold. I mean, I'm asking about a very practical way to apply. Let's say I am one of the most, and I'm not, downtrodden people of this earth. What do you say to me?
Well, I think that what we need and what we are in the process of is a spiritual revolution that will also be a scientific revolution. There are more and more books out, and I point to one by Robert Lanza, the stem cell guy, wrote a book called Biocentrism. He was named one of Time Magazine's most 100 influential people last year. His book, Biocentrism, is saying a lot of things that my book says. He's basically saying that the human consciousness is at the root of reality. So what has to happen, and this was written about by Thomas Kuhn in the Structure of Scientific Revolutions, is that when a paradigm no longer fits experience, it gradually collapses and a new worldview takes over. And I'm saying we are in that process. This is a gradual thing. What I'm trying to do is accelerate it because I want to be around when it happens. Okay? When we change, and I'm being optimistic here, then that means we're changing the way we teach people, we interact with people, and we learn. So all of a sudden, compassion, the golden rule, becomes ingrained in us. Not because someone told us it was a wise thing to do, or not because someone slapped us on the wrist with a ruler, but because it is part of who we are. And so I think that this is like a grassroots revolution, but it's also got to be a top-down. We need to change the way we teach kids. I have an article called "We Can't Rise to a More Spiritual World If We Only Teach Our Children About Materialism." It's out. I forget where it's published, on the web somewhere out there. But the long and short of it is that this is going to be a gradual thing, but we need to accelerate it, because ultimately the downtrodden, the poor, the starving, the homeless, they are part of the human family. And if you look at what materialism does, we ignore these people.
Okay.
We ignore these people, mm-hmm. And is that, what kind of compassion is that? And so, I'm not expecting a miracle overnight. What I'm hoping for is, as young people come in to the equation, as these ideas get spread around, as we have more people asking questions, raising their hands, doubting things, that we're going to see that there's nothing wrong with this. In fact, it makes more sense than materialism. Let's get on board and make something happen.
Okay, I think we have another caller on the line. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for a great program. I wanted to recommend the writings of Kierkegaard, who insisted that truth has to well up within us. It can't be commanded. And the writings of Jürgen Moltmann, the theology of hope, that it's hope that separates us from the rest of creation. We can go beyond everything that's past and present in the power of the coming, the power of the promise. And Hans Georg Gadamer, who wrote Truth and Method, he actually lived to be 100, and he was really insistent that the human sciences are very different from the natural or exact sciences. The difference is between experiment and experience, between inwardness and exactness. And of course, to me, we seem to be in a late stage capitalism where the sciences are trying to become mathematical. They're all trying to become natural sciences, where we're really governed by Humpty Dumpty's idea that words are what I say they are, or words mean what I say they mean. So language and democracy seem to be casualties in our elite democracy. What do you think of that? And have you heard of Hans Georg Gadamer? And his idea was that history was a unity of horizons, and that prejudice can be just a stepping stone to that event of understanding.
Okay.
Well, first of all, Kierkegaard was a big influence on me. You know, I do have a philosophy degree. And I think Kierkegaard influenced me to study philosophy. I'm not familiar with the works of the other folks, but what I think the message here is that we tend to forget is that it's important at one point of your life, at least, to come to terms with the big questions. You know, a lot of people think this is academic, it's deep, it's philosophical. Well, that's sort of true, but this is the only life that we have right now. And if you were flying a jet airplane, I think you probably would want to figure out how to fly it before you hit the air. And we are flying blind, many of us, because we haven't thought through these topics. So I think when you bring up authors like that, or who are obviously deep and thoughtful, that that's the kind of stuff that is inspiring, and it tells us that there's more to the world than meets the eye, that this is a deep, rich world, both inside of us and outside of us.
Okay.
So I think that's all good stuff.
We have Peter on the line. Hi, you're on the air.
I'd like it. Boy, this is an incredibly good conversation. I would like a list of some of those authors and books that you're throwing out there. It was mentioned in the conversation somewhere along the line that in, you know, the condensation in the compression to the tiniest point in order to create an explosion which might lead to another universe and all of that kind of thing in physics, that I don't want to get too far into that, but it's the Big Bang, but the merging of physics and and spiritualism, particularly Eastern spiritualism, is very insightful and wonderful. I might say that if consciousness was the result of that explosion, and it all is in consciousness and it is all inside us, which is absolutely correct in my opinion, there is only one. That's non-dual Vedanta, Advaita Vedanta, pure and simple. And I would love for the physicists who seem to be going along on a, some of whom seem to be going along on a parallel course with Eastern spiritualism, would have the freedom to say that that's a possibility, that consciousness is at the bottom of it, because what they're doing seems to me to lead to that conclusion, and even in terms of their physics. So carry on this wonderful conversation, and I would love to have many more like it. I appreciate having this author on the air. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Well, let's talk a little bit about quantum theory. We've been talking about the Big Bang. Let's talk a little bit about quantum theory.
Yeah, I mean, this is what the issue is with quantum theory, and that is, quantum theory teaches that the physical world is not made of stuff. Okay, I just happen to have in front of me, and I didn't plan this, but I happen to have in front of me a quote that I use a lot. It says, "The doctrine that the world is made up of objects whose existence is independent of human consciousness turns out to be in conflict with quantum mechanics and with facts established by experiment." This is Bernard Despanja from the Scientific American. Okay, this is a mainstream scientist saying that quantum theory teaches that there are no objects independent of consciousness. There's another article that was published in Nature magazine, Nature magazine being the most influential scientific magazine in the world, by Richard Kahn Henry. He says the universe is entirely mental. After going through his analysis of quantum theory, he says it's entirely mental. This is a physics professor at the Johns Hopkins University. So following up the last caller's point, mainstream scientists are and have reached this conclusion, but the truth of that fact, it has not penetrated the rest of the scientific community. It has not penetrated American or global culture, because what it teaches is that consciousness is at the root, and we should be more concerned about our internal states than manipulating tiny particles. And the best example of this is healing, the placebo effect, for example, how strong belief heals. I'm reading a book right now by Charles Dawson called The Genie in Your Genes, where he's talking about energy healing. The book You Are the Placebo by Joe Dispenza, very popular book. They're all talking about the same thing, how consciousness, positive intentions, healthy spirits, good attitudes, it heals the human body. So what I'm saying is that quantum theory connects with the placebo effect, you see, because if our bodies are necessarily part of the physical world, therefore we are really energy beings, as whatever, you know, I'm not sure if that sounds strange enough, but we're energy beings in an energy-filled universe, except the energy is coming from inside of us. It's not coming from outside of us. So quantum theory is an exciting thing. It's really, to me, the most powerful, indisputable evidence that consciousness is at the root of reality. Okay, and so I think it's something that everybody should read a couple books on quantum theory. I would recommend The Quantum Enigma by Bruce Rosenblum, or maybe The Matter Myth by Paul Davies, if people want to pick up. My book, The Collapse of Materialism, has a section on quantum theory as well.
So was that the last book, The Quantum Enigma?
The Quantum Enigma is a great book on quantum theory. It's by Bruce Rosenblum and Fred Kuttner. I've had Bruce Rosenblum on my own radio show. Mm-hmm. I said The Matter Myth by Paul Davies. And as I said, my own book has a summary of all this, of quantum theory as well.
collapse of materialism. But there's, if you're going to read one, I would read The Quantum Enigma, even though I guess I'm supposed to be plugging my own book, but read The Quantum Enigma, because those guys are physics professors.
What kind of work is going on in quantum, the quantum field right now? Is there any kind of research or anything? I don't know. You keep reading about scientific discoveries, and how do they relate to quantum theory?
Well, I think that, you know, there's really two. There's the theory, and then there's the application. Okay, as you probably know, there, Google and a bunch of other folks are experimenting with quantum computing, which I don't know much about other than it's mostly still on the drawing board. But in terms of the theory, I think what's going on right now is that we are starting to find, continuing to find, more and more odd features of quantum theory. You know, we used to think that the quantum effects were only on the very smallest scales, you know, the tiny, you know, the electrons and the photons. But they are finding quantum effects in bigger and bigger particles, which, of course, makes sense since the big is necessarily built up of the small. But then there's Dean Radin, the parapsychologist researcher, has a book called The Entangled World, where he uses quantum theory to explain parapsychology, which I think is also got some validity to it. But I think we're almost at the end of the road in terms of understanding what quantum theory is, and I think it's a function right now of incorporating the truth of quantum theory into our worldview, i.e. the world is entirely mental, just like Professor Richard Conhary says. It's a mental projection.
Well, either way, wouldn't the world as we see it look the same or feel the same? I mean,
exactly. Exactly. That's the main point. That is the main point. The world doesn't change. We have nothing to compare it to. Our attitude changes. So, our perspective, mm-hmm. and I think our appreciation changes.
Yeah, so I'm sitting here in this radio studio, and whether the ultimate reality is material or mental or whatever, is still the same day-to-day world. It's it's sort of hard to tell them apart sometimes.
Right. There's a passage from Plato's Theaetetus, and this is Socrates, and, you know, Plato being one of the top five thinkers of all time, Socrates essentially says, and I'm paraphrasing, he says, well, if you were dreaming right now, you couldn't tell a difference between dreaming and not dreaming. The world would still say the same. Our night dreams are very similar to our day world. It's one of power. Our day dreams are powerful because it's a united dream. Our night dreams are like solo ventures.
Oh, boy. Well, I think we're going to have to end there. We've had a very interesting 50 minutes here. We've been talking with Philip Camella, author of The Collapse of Materialism. Do you have any website that people can go to?
Sure. And the website is called, luckily, thecollapseofmaterialism.com.
Mm-hmm.
And I have, I said, my radio show, Conversations Beyond Science and Religion, where I have leading spiritualists, scientists, New Agers, the whole gamut on my radio show on webtalkradio.net.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay. Well, thank you very, very much. We've been talking to Philip Camella, author of Collapse of Materialism. Stay tuned for Moving On. Thank you.
This KABU program had been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Aladdin Theater, presenting The Pimps of Joy Time with Moon Hooch, Friday, October 17th. Tickets for The Pimps of Joy Time, October 17th at aladdin-theater.com. This is KBOO Portland. The time is 12 noon. Stay tuned for Moving On with your host, Lori Sonnenfeld, right after the KABU News at Noon.
It's time for the KABU News at Noon for Friday, October 17th. Leadership of the state of Palestine is poised to begin contract negotiations by handing over a draft resolution to the United Nations Security Council by the end of the month. Yasser Abed Rabo, the PLO secretary, announced on Wednesday that they're asking for the complete withdrawal of Israeli occupation that began in 1967, and this must happen before November 2016. Of the 15-member council, seven countries are expected to vote in favor of the resolution. These are Russia, China, Jordan, Chad, Chile, Nigeria, and Argentina. The PLO is looking to France and Luxembourg to approve as well. Yesterday, the United Nations voted Venezuela into the UN Security Council for two terms, with a final count of 181 out of 193 members. The late Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez tried to gain a position on the council during the George W. Bush presidency in 2000.